evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Brian Wansink. Wansink is the John S. Dyson Professor of Food Marketing and Nutritional Science at Cornell University and the director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. He's been involved with over 250 studies on food and brand issues and has recently published a very well-received book called Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, published by Bantam Books in October of last year. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Oh, I'm pleased to be with you. Thank you.
Listen, you've spent most of your professional life studying the psychology of food, how marketing affects eating habits. What got you interested in these subjects?
Well, one thing I found out is that you can have really smart friends who are really tuned in to all sorts of aspects of their life. They know politics, they know international trade, everything. They've got an opinion on everything. But if you ask them, hey, why'd you have ham and cheese today and not turkey and cheese? They'd go, I don't really know. And here's something that's so important in our lives, to our health, to our self-esteem, to our self-outlook in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. And even the smartest people in the world can't figure out why they had what they had. That's why I thought, if I could have uncovered, kind of sort of unmasked some of these things that influence our decisions, it could have some nice implications.
Wow, yeah, I find the subject incredibly interesting. But, you know, before we go into the specifics of your book, I want to ask you this. Why do you think this country of ours, which is so obsessed with diets, millions of dollars of books sold every year, Why is this country going through an obesity epidemic?
Well, there's a number of things that are going on. First of all, food's incredibly accessible, like it never was in the history of our, you know,
mankind,
species.
Probably. Yeah.
And it's also extremely easy to find, too. It's cheap, it's accessible, there's wide variety. Those are the three sort of formulas or three variables that really increase an explosion of weight.
Uh-huh. But, I mean, we've had access to fast food for like 30, 35 years now. But the obesity epidemic seems to have come upon us recently.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing that I'm wondering about.
Well, it's paralleling in a lot of other things. And one is the increase of discretionary income. We have a lot more money to afford a lot of the fast food that maybe 30 or 40 years ago, eating McDonald's was something we could do once a year, and that was a real treat. Hey, now we can do it twice a day, yeah. You know, within a mile if we want to. And, you know, back then it was really unheard of to eat out very often, and now there's enough discretionary income that we can do anything we want to, as much as we want to, as many times a day as we want to.
Yeah, and I think that discretionary income that you talk about makes it so that people don't want to stay home and cook.
Yeah.
That has happened culturally as well, yeah. Right. Yeah. So let's talk about your book, Mindless Eating. You begin the book by declaring that the average person makes over 200 decisions about food every day. I found that remarkable.
Well, it's unbelievable.
How can that be?
Well, if you ask most people how many decisions they make about food a day, they'd say between 15 and 30 is typically what the answer we get. But in reality, what happens is that even if you just look at breakfast, for breakfast, you don't just decide what cereal to have, but you decide whether to have half a bowl or a full bowl or a second bowl, whether to put skim milk or whole milk, whether to put a little or a lot of sugar, whether to put sugar on it all, you decide whether to cut up a banana. And it's unbelievable that before you even have your first bite of food, bam, you've made 15 decisions right there.
Huh.
So we've done this set of studies over and over and over again. We find that virtually everybody makes between 200 and 300 decisions a day about food.
God, that's amazing to me. I was thinking, how could that be? And I started thinking about it in my own life, and I still can't imagine being that indecisive is the first thing.
That's right. Well, you know, even it's the sort of thing that if you have a candy dish on your desk, every time you look at that candy dish, you essentially make a decision whether you want to have a piece of candy, whether you're going to, you know, fight and say no. And you say no, it still ends up being a food decision.
I see,
that happens 12 times a day.
We're probably not even conscious of some of them. So let's talk about specific studies. Tell us about the popcorn study that showed people will automatically eat more if you give them a bigger bucket of popcorn.
Oh, it's unbelievable. If you ask most people why they overeat, most people say, well, I overeat when I'm really, really hungry, or I overeat when the food is really, really good. In reality, we find these things are so far from the top reasons why we end up overeating. And to kind of look at this, what we did is we went to a movie theater right outside of Chicago and took people who had just finished eating lunch and were going to go see a movie called Payback. It was a Mel Gibson movie a few years ago. And what happened is when they showed up to the movie theater, even though they were just eating and even though they weren't hungry, we gave them a free bucket of popcorn that was either, you know, a medium-sized bucket or is really, really a huge bucket.
Mm.
But what we did was the pop corn in it was not fresh. It was 5 days old. It was this stale, styrofoam feeling, sort of almost rancid popcorn. It was terrible. They went in, they saw the movie. When they left the movie, we took their buckets and weighed how much they ate. We found that the people who had been given the big buckets ate 35% more popcorn, even though they were full and even though the popcorn was terrible. What happened was everything in that theater told them to continue eating. You know, the people next to them were munching away, so they dutifully munched. The screen, you know, you're watching this exciting movie on the screen, so what do you do in movies? You eat popcorn, so they dutifully munched. Those with the big box or big container.
Buckets, yeah.
Well, that suggested to them how much to eat, and they continually munched 35% more than the other people.
So what you actually found was people just eat out of compulsion in a lot of ways. Are they mimicking just their neighbors?
It ends up being a very mindless behavior. I mean, so many things around us, all these cues around us, are what kind of leak in and cause us to overeat. I mean, we find with people, for instance, we even find that when people are eating lunch or dinner or at a party, if you eat with one other person, you end up eating about 35% more food than you otherwise would. If you eat with seven other people, you eat closer to 90% more food.
God, that's remarkable. Yeah, I noticed that in your book. You've come up with some really remarkable indictments against human behavior.
So never eat with others. Eat in the closet by yourself.
I want to talk to you also about the Spice Box Lab. Especially the study when you did about the North Dakota versus California wines. Tell us about that one. I found that remarkable.
Well, one thing that we've done is we have a test restaurant. And the restaurant, you know, people come to it and they'll pay $25 to eat a meal. But in reality, it's just there for us to test different things that are going on.
People behave,
People behave. And one February, a couple years ago, people showed up for this nice prefix French dinner. And what we did is we gave them a complimentary glass of Cabernet Sauvignon that either said it was from North Dakota, a place not known for wine, or it said it was from California. Now, in reality, this is the exact same wine. It's this inexpensive wine called Charles Shaw wine.
Oh, yeah, the two-buck chuck. We know
right.
about that. Yep.
That's right. And we knew from a prior study that if somebody believes they're drinking a wine, it's going to be good. Hey, you know, they drink it, and they do think it's good. If they think it's going to be bad, like if it's from North Dakota.
Sorry, North Dakota.
Sorry, yeah, that's right. They drink it, and they go, oh, gee, that was just not too good. What we want to see is how it influenced the rest of their meal. If just drinking what they thought was going to be a bad wine or a good wine had an effect on the rest of the meal. And so Colin Payne, another researcher, and I did this study where we gave it to them. At the end of the meal, what we found is that people who drank California wine, they stayed a little bit longer, they enjoyed the meal a little longer, they ate a little bit more on their plates. And when they left, they were really quick to make reservations to come back. For people from North Dakota who thought they were drinking the North Dakota wine, the night wasn't so magical. They ate pretty fast. They left more food on their plate. When we asked them if they wanted to make reservations, you know, they said, you know, it's a really busy semester.
That is just remarkable. I thought that was a remarkable study.
Well, you know, the neat thing about
the power of suggestion, right? I mean,
which
has been spoken about many, many times by many different people,
Yeah, well, the neat thing about that, too, is there's a kind of a great takeaway for a lot of us when we're invited to a friend's house to bring wine or something like that, is that what do most of us do? Well, we go to the wine store, we pick out a price point, maybe $10 or $15 or whatever, and then since we don't really know exactly what we're doing, we just look for the bottle that looks the coolest. Well, yeah, you know, there's a lot to be said for that as a strategy, because if other people don't have tremendously sophisticated wine taste, we take a really nice-looking bottle, you know, they may be very well likely to be influenced by that bottle and say, yeah, good choice.
And marketers know about this.
I
want to talk to you about that marketing strategies. Putting exotic names in front of plain foods you found really influences people as well.
What's amazing, this cafeteria, this is back when I was a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, the person who's the director of the food service said, hey, look, we're trying to come up with a new healthy set of menu options for one of the cafeterias. Can you help us sell these things? And one of the things we did over a period of 6 weeks is we took all these different menu options and we changed the name. So, you know, one day something would be, you know, called the seafood fillet, And then a couple weeks later, it would reappear on the menu called the succulent Italian seafood filet. Now, in reality, it was just the same old dried fish stick. But it had this real evocative name. And we do the same thing. There was a chocolate cake. And somebody was talking, sometimes it was, we called it the Belgian Black Forest double chocolate cake. Same old dried sheet cake. But what we found is that after people ate these descriptively labeled foods, when we'd ask them what they thought, they would rate them as being tremendously tasty. You know, they liked the restaurant more. They rated, they even rated the chef as probably having European culinary training. No, I mean, this guy is getting fired from, like, Wendy's the week before. I mean,
you're giving away trade secrets Brian. Nobody's going to come to your lab anymore and be able to look you straight in the face and think you're being serious.
That's true.
But that is really remarkable, the way flowery words. I've always thought advertising, I wondered why people spent so much money on it, because I didn't think, come on. But you have proved in so many others, obviously, that the budgets of these marketing people prove that it's paying off.
Oh, yeah. But there's even great news you can use here if you do decide to have a dinner party or something, because if people come over and you take that pasta and you go, here, dinner served. People are going to eat it, and they're going to go, oh, thanks, that was nice. If you instead say, look, I've got some pasta that came from, you know, whether it be a family recipe or something.
Oh, yeah.
At least you put
grandma's old world
whatever. Put some descriptors in it. People are going to taste what they think they're going to taste. And they're going to, after dinner, instead of going, yeah, that was good, they're going to go, man, that was really nice. Thanks.
Now, another thing that I want you to talk about, you talk a little bit in the book about the difference between physical and emotional hunger. And I want you to talk to us a bit about that.
Well, sometimes we feel like we're having hunger pains. Sometimes it's emotional, but sometimes it's actually physical. And there's some rough rules of thumb you can use to determine whether the little craving you're feeling in your tummy is something that's going to pass or something that you better actually feed. And one thing is that if you're feeling an emotional hunger, it tends to kind of register above the neck. Or if you're feeling a physical hunger, it registers below the neck. Your stomach's growling, you feel sort of cramps, you feel some things sort of kind of sloshing around down there. Another cue you can end up using is what happens if you drink water. If you have physical hunger and you drink a glass of water, you actually feel a little bit full or a little bit sated. If you're feeling emotional hunger, you can drink all the water you want to and it's not going to go away.
People need to know the difference, right? I mean,
and also, if you're feeling physical hunger, it usually pops up 3 to 4 hours, or I shouldn't say 3 to 4 hours, but after 3 or 4 hours after you've eaten, whereas emotional hunger can pop up half an hour after you've eaten. So if that's happening, it ain't physical hunger at that time.
I want to talk to you about this other study that you did that really amazed me. This one I almost cannot believe. The one where you told people you were going to serve them strawberry yogurt.
Oh,
and you turned
off
the lights. Tell us the story. This is really unbelievable to me.
Well, I do a lot of work for the U.S. Army Natick Labs, because what they do is they design the MREs for soldiers and they do a lot of the feeding. And so much of what goes on there is psychological. And in some cases with soldiers, they end up eating during the dark. And they've always said that they don't enjoy their food so much if they're eating in the dark. And we wanted to figure out, was it just the cues are gone or what? So in this one set of studies, what we did was gave soldiers what they thought were two kinds of strawberry yogurts and asked them to rate the strawberry flavor and how much they liked them and things like this. In reality, these were not strawberry yogurts. What they were sour vanilla yogurts that we had added a little bit of Hershey's chocolate syrup to. But we gave it to them in the dark, and since they couldn't see the strawberry color, you know, they ate them. We said, okay, which one has the stronger strawberry taste? And they go, oh, man, you know, this one, it really tastes like strawberry. I like it a lot. You know, in fact, it's going to be one of my new favorite strawberry yogurts. What brand is it? In reality, it's just their entire imagination that's causing them to taste this yogurt.
That study was that remarkable to you, too?
Oh, it's so robust, too. It's crazy. An interesting thing, 2020 did a nice piece a while back, and they brought me down. And they said, we'd like you to do the same thing with our college interns. Did the same thing with seven college interns. It worked for every single one of the interns. They couldn't believe it.
My. I think I would be one of the people who would come out of your lab and be pretty upset about being fooled that way.
You know what? That's an interesting question. Because we've done studies with probably over 140,000 people over the last 20 years. And I've only had three people that really got mad at things. And the reason is, which is interesting, is that almost everybody who leaves the lab doesn't believe it happened to them. You know, they believe that this might influence other people on average, but hey, not me. I'm too smart. And so that's why most people just don't get mad.
God, that's really amazing. Now, you have found in your studies, people tend to eat more now that all these people are marketing low-fat foods. And it's a bad trick being played on people in some ways, right?
Well, it's a terrible trick we play on ourselves, too,
yeah.
Because what happens is anytime we see something that says it's low-fat, we tend to believe it's low calorie, but it hardly ever isn't. And in fact, if you look at snack foods, for instance, they do take all the fat out, but what they do is they replace that fat with sugar so that the taste is actually pretty good. So on average, the typical snack that's low fat is only 11% lower in calories. Most of us think on average it's about 40% lower in calories. And when we eat those snacks, we end up eating on average 28% more total calories. So here's something we don't like as much, because, hey, I've never found a low-fat food that is that's better than the regular. But here we're eating something we don't like so much, and we're eating actually more of it. I mean, that makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
One thing that we recommend people who come by for advice in the lab and people who go to our website, mindlesseating.org, is we say, hey, look, you know, rather than eat a lot of something you don't like, eat the regular version, but just eat a little bit less. You're going to be better off. You're going to like yourself more. You're not going to feel like you're depriving yourself.
I have a lot of friends in Europe, and they can't believe all the low-fat stuff Americans eat and all the seduction by thinking that they are getting lower calories. I mean, this could be one of the reasons why the obesity epidemic is becoming, in fact, an epidemic.
Oh, I think it contributes to it. Actually, the paper that this journal article that this study's published on came out just in November, and actually The Economist claimed it as one of the most influential management articles published in 2006. So, you know, that took about a month to come down from that one.
Wow.
Well, I think the first sentence is, we are a nation of low-fat foods and high-fat people.
It has become so. It's actually pretty amazing to me. Now, you also found that when food is less visible or accessible, people tend to eat it less. Tell us about some of the experiments you did about in offices.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing we did was in a large set of college offices, and what we did is it's ubiquitous in offices to find candy dishes on people's desks. It's sort of a social magnet, you know. People like having them. And what we did, we took a number of office workers, and over a period of a month, we gave them a bottomless bowl of Hershey Kisses. But we either put it on their desk, or we put it just 6 feet from their desk, and the bowl was either clear, so that these candies stared through said, eat me, eat me, eat me.
Luring.
Yes, that's right. Or it was opaque, white, so you couldn't see the candies, but you knew they were there. And what we did is every night we tiptoed down at 7 o'clock and counted how many candies they'd eaten and then refilled the bowl. And what we found was that the typical person ate about 9 candies if it was sitting on their desk. But if you just moved it 6 feet away, they only ate 4 candies a day. Now, you can say, I was presenting this at a med school a while back as one study, and this person says, well, that's not really a big deal. It's only 125 calories difference a day. And, you know, that is not a big deal for a day. Over a year, though, that's about 12 extra pounds.
That's the part of the statistic in your book that I found really quite amazing, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and even there, if you just, even when it was in the opaque bowl, people ended up eating a couple less a day, too, because, you know, it's not staring at you, so you're not reminded of it. But what's interesting is after the study was over, we'd talk to the people and we'd say, hey, you know, you ate so many less when they're just 6 feet away. Why is that? Is that too much of effort just to walk 6 feet? And people said, no, it's not that. It's just that 6 feet gave me enough pause to say, am I really that hungry? And half the time they'd answer no.
Yeah, well, that's a good tip for people.
Oh, it is.
Keep it away from your desk.
Or better yet, replace it with a fruit bowl.
Yeah, exactly. Now, a lot of people think that many food industry folks are trying to make people eat more. You know, you give the example of the Pop-Tarts. They come in a package of two, even though one is a serving. but talk to us a little bit about that. But you insist that that's not the case.
Well, so often the things that we sort of infer or want to kind of, you know, attribute to maliciousness can often be explained by very simple economic things. Like, for instance, with the Pop-Tarts, it was so expensive to set up the packaging line for the Pop-Tarts that initially, until they knew this was going to be a big success, they could get by with half as many packaging lines by putting two in a sack. And I've often heard people say, you know, that like a lot of fast food companies, they just want to make us fat. Mm. That's how they make money, is they make us fat. You know, they actually make money by selling you the food. They don't really care whether you eat that or not. And oftentimes, you know, why would a place like a fast food place offer such huge portions for such little amount? Well, because the guy next door does, and if they don't essentially match the value of the person next door is offering a huge fries and charging just 5 cents more. If they don't match that, they risk you spending your money over there instead of with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what's happening is I don't really know whether they care if you eat all their French fries once they grow cold. All they care is that you buy the French fries there to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who think there's a conspiracy, though, because
we have found
recently that the tobacco companies were lying to us, right?
Yeah, well,
they have actually put more nicotine in the cigarettes.
That's true.
So I know some people who say, oh, God, well, these food companies are tied in with the medical establishment, and they're all trying to make people sick because they're all making money off. You know, that's the connection that I think a lot of people are starting to be a little bit concerned about, the corporate America, you know, one entity, the medical aspect, the food aspect, a lot of them are merging.
The agricultural aspect, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
We'll contemplate that. We're going to be going down, I think, to Arby's for dinner today, so we'll contemplate that during lunch.
Whether the little paper menus have insulin ads.
That's right. Subliminal messages.
Yeah. One thing that you mentioned also in your book is this new philosophy that's come around, and I don't know how long it's been, the last 10, 20 years, to encourage establishments to list calories, portion sizes. And you say in your book that you have found that it doesn't really affect that many people and they don't pay attention to it.
Yeah. Well, there's a small segment that I'm very interested in. I was really fortunate to be a part of the FDA panel that made these recommendations about that they put calories on. But I was also one of the few voices that said, this is not going to really be a magic bullet. And if we don't see the needle move at all, let's not be disappointed, because we're making a step in the right direction, but it's not going to solve a whole lot. And secretly, what I even fear in some cases is that it causes things to backfire. We did a study that's coming out later this next year, and this is in the book Mindless Eating. It's called the McSubway Study. And what we did is, Subway's really seen as a big sort of a virtuous icon of disclosure, because they have every menu, every table tin, every glass has calorie and fat information on. Whereas McDonald's, you know,
It's a little bit more hidden.
Yeah, it is.
Well,
what we did is we went to 250 people who had just finished eating at a Subway and asked them, hey, do you remember seeing any information? And then we also said, what did you eat and how many calories do you think you ate? And the typical person at Subway, I think it was maybe less than 20% recalled seeing any information. And many of them recalled like wrong information, like, I know that my sandwich has only 7 calories. It's just like, Wait, seven
calories.
Was that like a moon calorie? What is that? but then we ended up finding that one of the things that happens is that if we ask people to estimate how many calories they end up eating, that typical person at Subway estimated they ate about 325. In reality, they ate about 700. You're really sort of overeating relative to what you think. Well, we did the same thing at McDonald's. And, of course, people at McDonald's eat more. But the person at McDonald's estimated they ate about 900 calories. In reality, they ate about 1,000. So they were much more accurate. I mean, they were still bad boys, but they knew it.
And you know, when they first started putting out some of those calorie counts and stuff, I was shocked at how many calories are in some of those fast foods.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, that one hamburger is equivalent to what people should eat in an entire day, certain people.
Yeah, well, and even with the healthy sandwiches, too, I mean, we call it a health halo in that, you know, you think you're eating a, you know, bacon chicken club, and that should be pretty good. You know, it's got chicken and that's healthy. It's Subway. Jared lost 7,000 pounds. You know? But really, you look at that thing, and it'll have like 850 calories or something. But our halo, the health halo we infer it, not only influences whether we think we deserve cookies during that meal and potato chips during that meal, but it also influences, we found, what people eat at dinner time. If they think they ate healthy at lunchtime, they think they can kind of overindulge a little bit at dinner. And that's where the danger of this health halo comes in.
Yeah, yeah. We're running out of time. We only have about a minute and a half left. To give some recommendations to our listeners about healthy eating. Just a couple tips here and there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in my new book, Mindless Eating, one of the things I tell people is that it's important to realize that the typical person doesn't overeat in all aspects of their life. There tend to be five diet danger zones that they need to focus on, and most people just need to focus on one. It could be meal binging, it could be snack grazing, it could be restaurant indulging, it could be party binging. But if you find the area that you're most tuned to, you can just find a way to make two to three 100-calorie changes, because that's not going to actually change your life. It's not going to
make
you
hungry.
Yeah, but those are just going to be small things. So, for instance, for dinner, one of the things we found is very effective is for people who have a meal binging problem. One very effective thing is just to simply move the serving bowls of the less healthy items, like, let's say, the starches and the meats, onto a side serving counter over onto the stove. We found in our studies that people who have moved those serving bowls just off the dining table end up eating an average of about 28% to 30% fewer calories from any bowl they move off their table.
That's amazing.
I mean, and then the alternative is you want to keep the healthy stuff on the table, because when you're having your seconds and thirds while you're waiting for your friend or spouse to finish, it's going to be the good stuff and not the macaroni and cheese.
that's a good tip to keep it out of sight, out of mind. Give us contact information, people get in touch with you.
We've got a website called mindlesseating.org, and we have something on there called the National Mindless Eating Challenge, where for people who want help sort of making some small changes in their life that can make a big difference, they can go there and sign up for free, and we'll stay with you week by week for as long as you stay with us.
That's great. Brian Wonsink, thank you so much for being with us.
And please, thank you very much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.